This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Ballot Box with me, Dashrin Johan. 2021 was certainly one for the history books. Malaysian COVID-19 death toll, the death toll reached a grim 31,000. We got hit by unprecedented floods, which approximately have affected around 70,000 individuals and counting. A state of emergency was declared, Parliament was shut down, and in and around all of this, elite-level politicking and musical chairs carried on as usual, completely detached from realities and sufferings on the ground. But perhaps there is also a silver lining to come out from all of this. Joining me on the show to discuss all of this is James Chai. He's a political commentator and a columnist at Malaysia Kini. Welcome to the show, James. How are you doing?
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm doing good.
All right. James, I painted a pretty grim picture perhaps in my introduction. Do you share those sentiments, or what are your overall thoughts on 2021?
I do think so, given the fact that 2021 was concentrated with a lot of bad events. And if we recount all of those bad events that happened, it's very hard to believe all of them happened in 1 year. So whatever you talked about COVID, we were one of the worst in the ASEAN and Asian region in terms of infection rates as well as death tolls on a per capita basis. At the same time, the natural disaster of a flood was also one of the worst that Malaysia has ever suffered, indicating, you know, the effects of climate change, as well as what is to come around the Southeast Asian region. But on top of that, like whatever you've pointed out, this was also coupled with a lot of man-made events. So primarily the coup d'etat resulting in two governments, the shutdown of parliament, the declaration of emergency, as well as a lot of economic effects. As a result of all of this, we have one of the worst economic recessions, one of the worst unemployment rates. At the same time, there's also this unprecedented expansion of B40 to B50, which is very drastic in the country, very difficult for us to reverse. I think what these events definitely signal is that it told us that we do not have the right leaders to handle crises. Granted, a lot of these events are also suffered by other leaders around the world, but at least it allows us to have this awakening of reassessing our leaders, of knowing what's important. But of course, like any crisis at all, every time we found the ability for Malaysians, ordinary Malaysians, to find a home in each other when they could no longer depend on the government.
Certainly. Now, you brought up coup d'etats and things like that, right? And that is something that I would like to zoom in on, because prime ministers, you know, whenever they take office, you know, they're great at, you know, these rhetorics, giving speeches and blah, blah, blah. And every prime minister that comes after that will say that they are going to make this big difference and all of that. And they're going to serve all Malaysians and things like that. We've had two prime ministers since Langkah Sheraton. Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin came in 2020. He was there all the way up till 2021. And then around September 2021, August, September, Ismail Sabri came to the fold after that, after this continuous nonstop political wrangling, power wrangling between the elites. So like, you know, both of them said, they are going to be different from the previous prime minister, from the previous leaders, and so on and so forth. But in reality, when it comes to issues that really matter, how did Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin perform, and as well as Ismail Sabri, so far, them and their cabinets, how did they do?
Yeah, I think that if we were to describe both of those administrations in one word, I think Tan Sri Muhyiddin's entire tenure was bounded by a sense of insecurity. Right. Whereas Ismail Sabri's tenure is now working on the basis of compromise. So how this has transpired, right, was that Tan Sri Muhyiddin, because he was insecure, he exacerbated a lot of the first-time crises that he has faced. Granted, once again, that Tan Sri Muhyiddin's tenure was also unlucky compared to Ismail Sabri, because upon his accession, there was already a lot of COVID incidents and hospital beds were running out. Our healthcare system is running on an emergency. So he faced a lot of crises that were unprecedented and considered a historic first in the country. It was made worse because he was only having half a seat or one seat majority, and therefore he constantly had to look over his shoulder. That meant that he had to reward people who are just loyal rather than competent in dealing with a crisis like that. He was very slow to act because he was always very worried about the implications, which are all characteristics that are very detrimental in times of crisis where you're required to act fast, give assurance, and to be able to sort of monitor the outcome, right? Whereas for Ismail Sabri, he inherited a government where these things were already improving. So he had a government where COVID-19 was already improving as a result of quick vaccination rates. At the same time, he learned a lot from what not to do from Tan Sri Muhyiddin's government. So he had this historic memorandum of understanding with the opposition, which necessarily shut down any criticism from the other side. At the same time, he passed the largest ever budget. And he assured his own power base that he's more in control compared to Tan Sri Muhyiddin. So all of this has created a sense of goodwill to the point that he's able to judge his own cabinet's performance at a 90% success rate. However, he was also given for the very first time a true crisis when the flood happened. So I actually think that although the flood was more contained and shorter term in its disaster reach, it actually made people angrier than the COVID-19 situation, because there was a lot of sort of the implications of the flood was probably greater linked to the inaction from Tan Sri, so Ismail Sabri's government. Right. So that necessarily meant that for the very first time as well, he is faced with a unique crisis that tests his crisis management skills. And once again, then we are confronted with the fact that although these two governments were led by different people, they consist of largely the same people who could not carry out the task well. So that necessarily meant that we are probably looking at a situation where both of them are not better than the other. And therefore, UMNO and Ismail Sabri cannot claim that they are doing better than Tan Sri Muhyiddin's government, even though they are at a recovery stage in terms of the economy and COVID and health and so on. And that's where it stands at the moment.
Now, James, you would think that with everything that went on in Malaysia, like you highlighted, it pretty much would have been a perfect opportunity in a way for the largest opposition bloc to show that they are different, that they are this solid and inspiring alternative. You know, we talk about floods, COVID, bread and butter issues, unemployment rate, all of these things. People were genuinely looking for a difference, for something, someone to show them that an alternative way. Yet it seems like, you know, when we look at sentiments on social media, when we ask around, it seems like most people did not get this from Pakatan Harapan. They were not very visible. I mean, very visible. Individuals were still doing fantastic work. I mean, people always point to the likes of Nurul Izzah, the likes of Hannah Yeo, and so on and so forth. But as a unit, Harapan were pretty much invisible. Would you agree with this?
I really think so. I think that at a golden opportunity like that, Harapan being the previous government from the last general election that we had should be seen as a clear alternative from whatever problems that we are going through. But I think the brand of politics that is being played by Harapan since its formation before GE14 has not been mature enough to adapt to the current times. So what that meant was that their brand of politics in the past has always been going on a negative trajectory, which is like we are anti-corruption, we are not UMNO, rather than trying to tell us what Harapan really is, right? So that necessarily meant that they were constantly just criticizing the current government when what the people actually needed was to show us an alternative that you can carry out the job. So that necessarily is a change in how people perceive politics these days, because many people are fatigued and disillusioned with the elites just caring for themselves. And they are more insistent in trying to evaluate ideas on both sides rather than just sort of like disliking the current administration, and therefore they would pick Harapan as a natural second choice. That doesn't happen anymore. So this year of wilderness that Pakatan is going through is not saved by the fact that there is this deadlock at the leadership level, right? So there is no vision and direction that was given up. At the same time, it seems that a lot of the top echelon of leaders in all of the parties that consist Harapan is not making a move in trying to transform the party and the coalition. Now, I've asked myself this for the longest time as to why are they so subdued? Why are they not making any changes in their own coalition and party, right? And I think that the main reason why they're not doing that is that they're afraid of the solution and therefore they are not confronting the problem. So what that necessarily meant was that Harapan, for the longest time since they left office after Lanka Sheraton, they were constantly saying that they have been booted out or like they were eliminated from government because there was a communication problem, right? Which means that if people knew how great Harapan's administration was, they would still be supporting them. I think that that's a diversion of what the real problem is. The real problem is that the leadership is too old, a bit outdated. At the same time, there's no new ideas, no new leaders coming up. All of that symbolizes more like a systemic problem within the coalition. But because the solution requires them to step out of the scene or to even dismantle the coalition altogether and overhaul internal political parties, that choice is just too drastic and too scary. And therefore, none of them want to confront it. And therefore, they're going through this vicious cycle of uncertainty leading to bad performance in state elections. And this bad performance in state election leads to demoralization and then further uncertainty. That's the sentiment within Harapan now.
Do you also think that Harapan has sort of lost its way, especially since Lanka Sheraton? They seem to be more focused on pandering to the conservative base sometimes, you know, and not in a in a constructive manner, no less. It's there, you know, they have been caught up in the whole arguing about Tima whiskey, and you know, even someone from Harapan said it's similar to drinking Malay women, you know, these kinds of stuff. They were caught up in the whole Derhaka drama in parliament, and this is what you sort of remember Harapan for over the past 1 year or so. And they seem to have ignored the base, the core base that put them there in the first place. And they also, you know, they focused on all these things instead of being a legitimate force that champions people's causes, or like you mentioned, you know, something, you know, have an old their own economic ideology or something perhaps.
I really think that this sense of being lost in direction is very evident within the coalition now. So I think what is going through are a few things, right? One is the external factor that's changing and they're not adapting well to it. And one is this internal tussle that they're having, resulting in many inconsistent statements or like sort of like unconstructive, like what you said, criticisms on current issues, right? So the external environment necessarily means that in GE14, you could run on the huge anger of the people being very anti-AMNO, and you are the champions of people who do not like AMNO anymore. Because the huge anger was culminated from 1MDB and Najib, right?
That's right.
You really wouldn't have that again. And therefore, sometimes to a certain extent, right, you would notice that from 2020 onwards, Harapan is constantly waiting for the next scandal to transpire. When there is this, you know, Najib's sort of house that was given by the government, that's in the millions. They were banking on that for the longest time in parliament because it felt so familiar to them that that's something that they can do. They can actually whack on the larger scandals that exist, and they hope that it was just larger to the degree of 1MDB so that it gets people all riled up again, right? But the external environment has changed because that kind of scandal is very unlikely in this condition again, that you know, political elites are just more cautious. At the same time, the people do not necessarily buy into that anymore, right? So they want some people as voters are also gaining more maturity in terms of how what we demand from politicians, right? Now, internally, what the tussle is going on right now is that I don't think that all the component parties, AMANA, PKR, and DAP, necessarily feels that the Pakatan Harapan coalition is beneficial for them. They are only there because they do not have an alternative place to go to. In the state elections, all of the parties function independently with their own machinery, their own messaging, and their own candidates, right? Even their own flags. So what that necessarily meant was that it was very sort of demoralizing for them. And it almost doesn't make sense for each of these parties to champion Harapan so much. So what that necessarily means, that there's no plan or ideas that are rolled out by all of these three parties. They don't work together cooperatively. It's just that they don't kill each other. That's the baseline of it, right? So when right. It comes to a demand issue, there is no congruence in terms of what they think. They just allow individual parties to have their own opinions. And in the end, that is Harapan, however you want to find it from the mud, right? So that really is the state that they're currently in. I really think that if they are serious about actually trying to make this work, they need to probably reevaluate whether Harapan is still necessary or whether they should go on their own. At the same time, individual parties must definitely have new leadership to have a refreshed understanding so that they can compete with the likes of Muda and Warisan.
On the show with me today is James Chai. He's a political analyst and columnist at Malaysia Kini. After the break, we discuss the rise of the people. We'll be back with more on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is James Chai. He's a political analyst and a columnist at Malaysia Kini, and we're discussing 2021, the year that was in Malaysian politics. So James, speaking of Muda, when it was first formed, many from the government to the opposition, the likes of Tun Dr. Mahathir, to some analysts as well, said that Syed Saddiq and his band of individuals that he sort of put together or came together to form Muda was inexperienced, and this was just like a hype party on social media, and then that the party would be definitely dead on arrival. Now, looking at it, 2022, you know, it's a new year. Looking at the events that have transpired since Syed Saddiq first announced that he was starting this party, do those sentiments still hold true?
I think 2022 could very well be the year of Muda if they actually consolidate their support well. So there are a few things that they need to complete to make them a very tangible choice for the next election. The first one is that they should target seats, and if they can win around even 5 seats, right, or just any seats at all, that would already be a huge achievement for them. What they need is bargaining power at the seat, and seat at the table, right? So that's very important. The second thing is that they should not compromise on areas that existing politicians have compromised on. And lastly, they must be able to give some new ideas and own those ideas. And they would already be a very good choice. A lot of what MUDA will benefit from is also an environment of politics where it is extremely lethargic and very, there's a huge inertia for change, right? So although I talked a lot about Harapan just now, I very much think that Harapan will still continue with this lineup into GE15. At the same time, UMNO and Bersatu will continue to tussle. PAS will still remain as a fringe party. And therefore, MUDA would seem as a very attractive alternative, even though not as a government. They just need to be reminded as a contrast to the existing political situation. That would be enough, right? Mm-hmm. However, I do think that their challenge is less upon the overall perception that people have of them. I think they would be able to do well because they have existing goodwill from the flood relief. At the same time, young people just have more progressive ideas these days, right? I think, however, their challenge is the tactics to be adopted in the next election. So MUDA appeals the most to the most urban crowd, right?
Right.
But the most urban crowd is currently at a heavy majority in favor of Pakatan Harapan candidates, which means that you have places like Hannah Yeo's constituency, or you have Fahmi Fazil. All of them are doing quite well in their areas with high majorities. And that necessarily means that if MUDA wants to compete in these seats, would they be able to take so much from Harapan to the point that they win that seat from them? Very unlikely, right? The alternative, therefore, is that they need to contest in semi-urban seats. Those are the ones where majority is lower. At the same time, the candidate is not that well-known and therefore would necessarily be quite open to voting for MUDA. However, semi-urban seats are not necessarily young, which means that there are not many young voters. You need to rely upon older people are giving young people a shot.
Right.
Only then they'll win those seats. The unfortunate thing is that a lot of the young people are actually concentrated in rural areas, which means that rural seats are the ones with the highest concentration of young voters. So you have places like Gua Musang, a lot of the Kelantan and Terengganu seats are the ones that would benefit from the infusion of young voters, right? However, those are the seats that MUDA are very unlikely to have a hold on. And being more conservative in those seats, they would probably think that MUDA is too inexperienced and they won't form government anyway, and therefore there's no point voting for them. So that, I think, is probably the greatest challenge, right, that should be paid attention to. Because if you target seats early, you'll be able to work on those constituencies earlier. And that necessarily means to me, although the front-facing part would be done quite well and being led by Syed Saddiq and his team that's very, very well run when it comes to social media, I do think at the back of it, the tactical aspect is probably something that could be refined in this 2022, which is the first year of their existence, which I think would make the difference step.
Right. Now, on top of all of this, we talk about a lot of the elite politicking side of things, MUDA and all of that. But now let's talk about the stuff that's going on the ground. Because one thing that has been rather inspiring to watch unfold, especially over the past few weeks, was how everyday ordinary Malaysians banded together during the floods. We talk about, let's say, Gurdwara Sahib, PJ, it was working nonstop from dawn to dusk to help flood victims. Regular people came together. They managed to mobilize like so many people. It was nonstop. People were tweeting on social media how they were dropping off stuff at the Gurdwara. People were cooking and all of that. We hear stories about regular people just coming together with kayaks and boats to rescue as just even a few people, whatever they can, they just, you know, did it. Migrants and refugees swam in flood waters to acquire food for their Malaysian neighbors. And even Parti Muda, very new party, it's not so much about Syed Saddiq, but how they managed to mobilize very quickly more than 5,000 regular Malaysians, most of them are youth. What does all of this signal politically?
I think what is great about what we saw through the heartwarming scenes in the flood, as well as during COVID-19 earlier, where people were just setting up food banks on their own, people donating to charity or like setting networks to help people who has raised the white flags and so on. All of this has definitely shown you one thing that was very evident, which is ordinary people, people like you and I, are still people who love this country as well as their brothers and sisters who exist here, even though they are strangers, we treat them like family. So what was great around that, you know, let's just talk about the flood, right? Mm-hmm. Was that a lot of those assistance happened so organically that it snowballed in such a short period of time that none of the government units could actually compete. So that shows you that there is something innate in the goodness of Malaysians, as well as this creativity in helping the other person, sacrificing some of your health and potentially risking your life to help another person, is definitely the hallmark of what moral courage is that is severely lacking among the political elites. So it's unfortunate that it took us tragedies to realize that contrast between political elites and ordinary people. But I think that should renew Malaysians' faith in constantly working on this Malaysian project, even if we are at this juncture where we do not have a clear idea of which political party to go for and so on. It's always like that. When you cannot rely upon people at the top, you rely on each other at a horizontal level. And that is something that is very reassuring for Malaysians who are at the brink of losing hope, leaving the country, or like just totally shutting down altogether. You should look at these stories to help you renew your faith in the country.
James, do you think the elite politicians are looking at all of this and shaking a little bit? And I'm asking that because elite politicians, when you look at history and things like that, right? Elite politicians, those that are there for power and their own benefit and things like that, they benefit from a fractured society, from a divided society. But this, from the incidents that we have seen, and they also benefit from a society that that believes that they cannot function without, you know, a lot of help from the government, direct assistance, coordination from the government. But the past few weeks have showed that the people are surviving and they've come together in spite of the elite politicians, in spite of their slow response and things like that. And on top of that, we are seeing more people, just regular people, for example, or like NGO, civil societies, together with people, you know, suing the government, for example, or taking them to the court. The folks at Undi Sarawak did it, and the lowering of the voting age was forced to be gazetted by the courts. The folks from Muda, which again, only one person is an MP. The rest are, you know, regular Malaysians and all. And you know, they took it to court, and the ROS was forced to register them. Finally, even things like, you know, the Malaysian women or foreign spouses, you know, previously they couldn't confer citizenship to their children born overseas, but that was also, you know, pushed in court. It has been for and then the court decided that no, you know, they should be allowed. So the court basically told the government that no, you cannot, that law is draconian, it's sexist, and so you have to allow these women to confer their citizenship. What does all of this tell you?
I I think the fragmented nature of politics today has definitely opened up opportunities for ordinary people to fill in that void. So what that necessarily means is that a lot of these court cases, they're either brought against the government, which is also very, very rare in the past, where you right. challenge a government's authority. At the same time, there are a lot of judicial decisions, right? They are made by the court that were considered to be very progressive, and it renews your faith in the independence of some of these institutions, right? Where you do not see this overreaching nature of government agencies as you had during maybe Najib's time or let's say Mahathir's time in his first administration. You do not see those kind of acts as much, right? So what that means is that a fragmented politics actually weakens the authority of existing governments. And if they are still very much preoccupied with, you know, a power grabbing, they would actually lose that sense of legitimacy that the people confer upon them, which they still very much rely on. Now, the other thing that is happening in society now is that there is this phenomenon called the network effect. So what that means is that ordinary Malaysians who feel like the government is being very incompetent, very useless, very slow, they are not alone because they know other people feel the same way. So if you have that sense of camaraderie with other Malaysians, you are more likely to be vocal. You are more likely to want to speak out and endorse other views that are similar to yourselves. And that necessarily created this sense that there's an uprising among the people because it just happens so much faster, right? And the government are actually too slow to even capture that. What this necessarily means to on a historical trajectory, right, was that in the past, politicians can just ignore all of these views and just make their decision because politics and society and what happens overall to Malaysia is very much determined by the few political elites in the cabinet room. That will no longer be the case now where politics have changed and there's this sense that you need to listen to the people on the ground, and there will be this vengeful voting by a lot of these voters in the next election. And a lot of these politicians are aware of it, but it hasn't bit them yet because there is no election to actually make that known. However, there's a lot of concessions that are already being made by the existing governments that are created as a result of a lot of these public pressure, which include, of course, the UNDI 18 implementation, which I think is definitely a symbolic reminder of the results that could be produced by ordinary people banding together.
All right, James, before we wrap this conversation up, I want to get final thoughts. 2021 was a bad year overall. As we mentioned, you know, just to reiterate, we're talking about 31,000 deaths when it comes to COVID-19. That has still continued until 2022. We're talking about more than 70,000 people affected by the floods, households submerged, all of these things. Unemployment and underemployment are on the rise. So many bread and butter core issues. But are the people rising from the ashes? Is there a silver lining to all of this?
I think that in a year mired with tremendous crises as well as bad events, there are actually a few things that would permanently shift that would be beneficial for us. The first one is that this idea that we have seen through politicians and what they want, and we cannot totally rely on them, and we need to rely on each other, would actually be a very important form of awakening, because that necessarily means that you need to participate in this nation building thing between elections. At the same time, there are more that you can do and you can make happen, even though you're not a politician, right? So there's a lot of this kind of new awakening that would be helpful in helping to shape the overall psyche of Malaysians in relation to nation building. The second benefit that we have had was that a lot of these politicking has also brought about unintended consequences that are beneficial for the democratic institutions in the country. So like I mentioned just now, a fragmented politics necessarily elevates the independence of institutions.
Right.
There's more space for judiciary, there's lesser interference to the media, and other government agencies would follow suit in something that they want to. Because there is no point in the existing establishment interfering too much in these institutions because these institutions will not react or follow your orders necessarily because there may be a new government coming into place soon, right? So you do not have that stranglehold as you had in the past anymore. So that is one unintended consequence. The other unintended consequence is that because we have so much politicking at a state level as well, having more state elections that are different from federal elections is actually good for the country, where people in that state start paying attention to who represents them on a more local level, on a state level, rather than just a parliamentary federal level.
Right.
Right. So that is also something that's beneficial in changing the psyche of how people think about politics, because it's really about who represents you as an individual candidate, right? How they can serve your area rather than just which party they come from. And the last thing, of course, which is still something that's very exciting to this country and still to be seen, is young people, right? So it's quite evident at this stage that young people are more progressive on many levels compared to their parents. At the same time, they are more energetic, more engaged in politics than ever before, right? So we never really had that many young people at once being informed with what's going on in the country and have this sense of right and wrong for the next generation. So I think all in all, 2022 is a year where we can rely on all of these lessons. And continuing to push forth with what we want in this country. So in spite of this sense that all is lost, a lot of this learning is something that would benefit the country in this year ahead.
On that note, James, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me, Dr.
That was James Chai, political analyst and a columnist at Malaysia Kini. If you missed any part of the conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or wherever you get your podcast from. You just have to search Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashan Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.